See, Ron, we're going to need this blackboard over here. Afraid if I get it myself, I'll knock it over or something. I'm being kind of helpless by myself. I remember I went down to Amarillo, Texas one time, and we had a little rally, and I was going to show a film strip and give a little talk, and I had to do everything myself, and I broke the film strip and generally messed up the whole program. And I didn't realize how dependent I'd become upon others. And I told them the story that perhaps you've heard of the football team that had such a dismal season. And this was the last game of the season. They had won none, but they were playing the league leaders. And by some quirk of some kind or other, they were tied 6-6 going into the last of the last quarter. If you've heard this, you'll know where to laugh. And the coach said, "Now look, we've got the ball. If we can just hang on to this and have a tie, it'll be a moral victory for us. This will end the season on the upsweep. Let's not lose that ball." He said, "I want you to go in there and I want you to make two quarterback sneaks and then I want you to punt that ball." So perhaps you've heard this, but they went in and the quarterback took the ball and he went to his sneak and he ran 30 yards with it before he got tackled. So he called the second play. And he ran right on down with a 3-yard line on the second play. And so, sure enough, third play, he got back and he kicked the ball clear into the stands. And then the gun went off and they were trotting off the field and the quarterback came along and the coach came up to him and said, "Son, what in the world were you thinking about there? If you had just gone right once more, why, we'd had a touchdown. What was on your mind anyway?" He said, "Well, I was thinking, boy, what a dumb coach we've got." Since we all like to increase our repertoire of stories, I finally came across a story that tells why I am president of the Navigators and have been for quite a while. And it's another sports story. Perhaps you've heard this one too, but I like the application. This was spring training, and the new manager had his ball team down in Florida, and he was watching his second baseman, who was doing a terrible job of playing second base. So the next inning came up in this practice game, and the manager said, "Look, second baseman, you sit here in the dugout, and I'll go out and play that position for you and show you how that position ought to be played." So he got out there, and the inning had no sooner begun when somebody hit a line drive right at him and went right through his legs and right on out the field. A little while later, the manager dropped a perfect throw from the catcher and in general did a very terrible job on second base. When the inning was finally over and he came back on in, he trotted up to the dugout, he slammed down the glove on the ground and he said to his second baseman, he said, "You've got that position so messed up that nobody can play it." Now, that's why I haven't been president of the Navigators for so long. I've got it messed up so much that nobody can play it. Well, now the topic for tonight is using management principles in a spiritual ministry. I don't know if we think that can be done or not. I hope I can communicate on this a little bit. I think that they can be used. I don't think necessarily management techniques, but management principles. The management principles are only a handful, but there are 1,000 books on how they were applied in differing circumstances. So I don't know as anybody can tell you how to apply them to your situation. I think that has to be done by each of us ourselves. But the principles are there nevertheless. You know, don't you find that when things get all fuzzy and you're just swamped with things to do and it's coming to you from every direction, and the do list gets so long that you don't know where to get into it, that one thing it's good to do is stop for a minute, take a little walk, and think through on what are really the basics. I mean, what is really fundamental? What are really the least common denominators? A few years back, some of you may remember, West Point had an All-American football player by the name of Pete Dawkins. Pete was also the first in his class. He was a Rhodes Scholar. And I don't know what other honors, the most honors that any student, at least up to that time, had gotten in West Point. Then he went over to, it was either Cambridge or Oxford. He learned to play rugby, made their team. He also made their hockey team. And one of our fellows had gone to school with Pete, and I said, tell me about Pete. How does it come that he was good in so many things? And he had a ready answer, and I think he's probably right. He said, Pete was able to analyze any sport or given activity, determine what its basic fundamentals were, and then apply himself to those. And I thought, that's great advice. What are the fundamentals? Find out what they are, the least common denominators, and give yourself to those. And usually we find that they are blessedly few and blessedly simple. But somehow or other, life seems to go about getting increasingly complicated, doesn't it? And so we've all heard the initial SIBKIS, see it big, keep it simple. Or somebody that just put the notes in the margin, KISS, kiss. What do you mean, kiss? You keep it simple, stupid. But you know, I've decided that that's maybe a clever little way of remembering it, that stupid people can't keep it simple. To get a thing simple takes an extreme amount of thought. To think through all of the breadth of the thing in order to reduce it to its least common denominators in such a way that you do, in fact, have the least common denominators. Well, I'm going to try, if I can, this evening, to just help us to think through on some very simple, and if we've done a good job, they will be simple, basics, of the Christian ministry and administry. And when we get all through, we might say, well, what good did it do go all over those? Well, I don't know if it helps you, but it helps me tremendously to know what I ought to do next. Doss Trotman used to say that action is no substitute for, or that emotion is no substitute for action. And action is no substitute for production. It isn't that we're to be busy, it's we're busy at the right things. It isn't how much money you spend or how much energy you put out, it's what do you get for that? What are the results? And life is too short for us to be spinning our wheels, isn't it? A couple years ago, I went to an American Management Association week-long institute for presidents of corporations. There were 37 corporation presidents there. I was the only president of a religious corporation. And we all sat around a huge round table. And I had been tipped off that the opening meeting, they would go around and ask each person the name of their company and a little bit about it, what they did. So I was ready when they came around to me, and I just simply said that we seek to persuade young men and women to commit their lives to Jesus Christ. We help them to become better followers of His, and then to find their most useful place in society. Well, it was very interesting. I hardly had a coffee break or anything else to myself for the rest of the week. And oftentimes they would come up to me and they'd say, tell me, what is that business you're in? Of course, they knew, but they wanted to hear it all over. And so I experimented with various ways. I said, well, we're in the disciple-making business. And that usually drew a blank. But then I tried something else. I said, well, we're in the business of meeting people's spiritual needs. And that always got through. And then I'd say, and our answer to people's spiritual needs is the Christian answer. And then if it looked like they wanted a little bit more, I'd say, and if you like to peg us a little bit more precisely, we are those Christians who believe that Jesus Christ is who He claimed to be, and that the Bible is what it claims to be. Well, who did He claim to be? Or what do you think that was? Well, we believe that Jesus Christ claimed to be the Son of God, and He is that. We believe that the Bible is the Word of God. And these are the two foundation stones, incidentally, aren't they, of all evangelical Christianity. It's interesting how through the Bible those two things are linked together. Jesus said, whosoever shall be ashamed of me and of my words. And haven't you noticed? Of course you have. In witnessing and all the rest, you can talk about God, you can talk about generalities, but when the name of Jesus Christ comes up in the conversation, there's a tension in the air. We find in college campuses that you put up a bulletin board, a poster, and you say, is God relevant today? That poster stays there. But you put up there, is Jesus Christ relevant today? And it gets torn down. There's something about that. And we've all experienced, you're riding along on a plane, you've got your Bible open. There are people reading Playboy, all kinds of books and so on. Nobody seems to pay any attention. But there you are, sitting there reading your Bible, minding your own business, and you happen to look up and you see people going... Well, you're reading it for a while, and the stewardess comes over and says, my, you must like that book. Yes, as a matter of fact, I do. Why do you ask? Well, you've been reading it for a long time. So, yes, I've been behind in my regular reading program, and I'm catching up a little. Why is that? There's something about it. Jesus Christ in the Bible. Now, that's our platform, isn't it? The Lordship of Christ and the authority of the Bible. We get our guidance, our philosophy, whatever it is, our marching orders from Christ. And I probably have 20 books on management in my office. I probably read a dozen or 14. But everything has to be checked back with the Bible. Whether it's a book on psychology or management or whatever it is, we can get some very valuable insights, can't we? And oftentimes they help us to see things that are there all the time that we didn't see if someone hadn't brought it up from a different angle. But we try to keep checking back. Now with that in mind, let's review some of the very basic things about the Christian ministry, and let's start from the beginning. I'm talking about the ministry now. The administry later. Now, to start a Christian ministry... A key verse is Proverbs 24:27. Prepare your work outside. Get everything ready for you in the field. And after that, build your house. It's a principle to get the ministry going, the ministry, before you begin to work on the administry. I remember a fellow who left the Navigators years ago, and he was kind of disgruntled. He was particularly disgruntled with how slow we were moving, and he wanted to get a ministry going in France. So the first thing he did was to get a board of directors and to get some brochures and have a beautiful outline of their goals, their objectives, their program, and all the rest in France, and get those distributed. And that's been 20 years ago, and he never did get to France. On the other hand, Dick Hillis, who started Orient Crusade, started right. He went out to Formosa and did some evangelism and giving out gospels and Bible studies. Then he came back to get some more money and some more help to go out and do that. He did the ministry, and later he was forced to get some kind of an organization so they could have tax-deductible receipts and one thing and another. This is what he's talking about here. If you're going to start farming, don't start by building your house. Start by putting the crops in. Then take a little corner of the land and stick up a piano box or something to live in. The ministry first, the administry second. And it's amazing how many people make the mistake. They want to start with the administry, the organization. Now take Jesus' ministry, for instance. How did he start his ministry? How did Jesus start his ministry? What? No, he didn't. That's right. Mark 1:14, he went preaching the gospel. Now, there are some people who have the idea that the first thing you should do is go out and get 12 men. That is not the first thing Jesus did. Now, we tell a navigator, if he's going to go out to the Philippines or Africa or wherever, the first thing you've got to do yourself is not go out and organize other people's Christians. We want you to go out there and you get on that campus and you, by the Spirit of God, win some of those students to Christ. You've got to do it yourself. You can't go out and tell the Filipinos in those churches how you used to do it back in the U.S. of A. Because we found this out, and so have other missions by experience, that if you go out to the Philippines, having been successful in the States, and you go around church to church telling them how you used to do it back in the States, gradually something begins to die inside, and by the end of the first term, you don't just feel much like going back. You've got to have a personal ministry of your own. Get out there and preach the gospel. Now, you may need an inside man. There are some ways to do it. How do you get on a campus? Those are techniques. But you start by preaching. Then Jesus made some disciples, right? Out of this preaching came disciples. Then what did he do? Then we come to Luke 6:12, where he chose the 12. He called unto him the disciples, of whom he chose 12, whom he named apostles. He didn't choose the 12 to be disciples. They were already disciples. He chose the 12 to become apostles. And why did he choose them? To be apostles. And Mark 3:14 says that they might be with him and that he might send them forth to preach. In other words, that he might multiply the ministry. But he started out with his own. Now, I don't know how it is with you, but I find that for me and in the Navigators, we've got to constantly, forever, be getting back to the objectives. I carry around with me my job description. And the second point on my job description is to set, clarify, and maintain the objective. And I never go to a staff conference, and haven't for 15 years, but what at some point, some way, somehow, I always get back to the objective of the Navigators. I remember one of our staff guys, we've been hammering on this, and Bob Foster picked him up, and he was driving down the road, and this guy said to him, said, "Now tell me, Bob, what is it? Now once more, what is it we're trying to do?" Now, the objective of the Christian ministry is right here, isn't it? You remember, which Bonar wrote that Words to Winners of Souls? Andrew or Horatius? Horatius Bonar, Words to Winners of Souls. We might even have it here, I don't know. He said, "I take it that the objective of the ministry is to win the lost and to build the saved. And unless the lost are won and the saved are built up in the faith, we're not on the track of the ministry. Whatever else we may do, and there are other things to do, at the very heart and center of it is the winning of the lost and the building of the saved." Isn't that right? "On this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." We're going to build up people who will go down and assail the gates of hell and win people to Christ, bring them back, build them up, send them down to do battle, to build them up, to do battle. Build, win, build, win. That's it, isn't it? I remember reading a book called Lincoln and His Generals. It's telling what a difficult time President Lincoln had in finding generals who seemed to know what the objective of warfare is. Now, he had one by the name of McClellan who was obsessed with the idea of capturing Richmond, Virginia, which was the capital of the Confederacy. Now, had he captured Richmond, Virginia, what would he have accomplished? He would have Richmond, Virginia. The difficulty is that General Lee's army was not in Richmond, Virginia. And all he would have done would have been occupied real estate. Whereas the objective of war is to engage the enemy's forces in combat and to defeat them and their will to resist. You've got to come in contact with the enemy, not just occupy real estate. So in the Christian ministry, I like to say, "Well, okay, Navigators, you're in 24 countries." Oh, man, what a big work. That didn't say anything. All that says is we've got people that call themselves Navigators in 24 countries. That's all that says. That doesn't say anything about anybody being one to Christ. Doesn't say anything about disciples being made, people built up. And it may look very nice on our brochures. Look really great if we put it on the letterhead. You can list all those countries. But so what? That's simply real estate. Now, in order to multiply himself, he chose 12. Now, an interesting thing here is, he still didn't organize it. I can't find any way there that Jesus chose 12, and then he gave 1/12 of his ministry to Peter, another 12th to John, another 12th to Andrew, and then he organized it. I find in the Navigator, some of our guys began to organize their ministries too soon. I remember we went one place, and the guy, our representative, had a great idea on the campus. There were dorms up in the northern end of the campus. There were dorms in the southern end of the campus. So he called them the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom. Isn't that neat? And so he put a man over this one and a man over that one. The first thing I wanted to know when I got to town is, what does the representative do? What is he doing? He didn't have a work big enough to organize. He didn't need a key man here and a key man there. He needed to do evangelism here. He needed to lead those Bible studies. And if you multiply this thing all up, you got all chiefs and no Indians. I have a little talk I give once in a while. Who's building the wall? I'm shuffling paper back here. Who's building the wall? In the Navigators. Let's get out on the wall. This is what it's all about. And you have to be brutal and ruthless almost with that, don't you? Oh, we can think of every excuse under the sun. And of course, in our kind of work where people are on their own initiative, they can stay home all morning, they can be changing the baby's diapers. Maybe that's necessary, but maybe it's not. Maybe necessary, but I mean, it may not be necessary for Dad to do it. Are you out on the campus? So, as I'll explain a little later, we work on that. Now then, so there's a simple basics of the ministry as I see it. You got to preach the gospel, win the lost, build the saved, and choose and train some leadership. That's about its simplest essence as I can see it. Now let's look at Paul's ministry. Let's look. Turn over to Acts 14 for a minute. Acts 14, starting with verse 21. We're talking about ministry now, not administry. When he had preached the gospel to that city and made many disciples, they returned to Lystra and to Iconium and to Antioch, strengthening the souls of the disciples, exhorting them to continue in the faith, and saying that through many tribulations we must enter the kingdom of God. And when they had appointed elders for them in every church with prayer and fasting, they committed them to the Lord in whom they believed. Well, they preached the gospel to that city. Preached the gospel to that city. Made many disciples. Now, Paul had a traveling team with him like Jesus had. Timothy, Titus, Aristarchus, Secundus, Gaius, and so on is recorded in Acts 20, verse 8, where they happen to be all together. So he had a traveling team, even as Jesus had 12 in Acts 20, verse 8. It talks about 7 of Paul's men. Then Paul, it seems to me, in his ministry, he established churches. It says there that they ordained elders. They established local congregations and elders. And I may be wrong about this, but I think this is as far as Jesus' actual earthly ministry went. He didn't establish churches. Now you might say, it's, at least it seems to me, that our ministry then is to preach the gospel, or win the lost, build the saved, train some leadership, and establish our church and churches. Now, these two require very little organization. You and I can go around and preach the gospel and win people and make disciples without much of an organization. The moment we start to multiply ourselves, then we begin to get into administrative problems, organizational problems, don't we? Therefore, I tell the navigators that the highest good, the most desired thing in the navigators in our ministry is to be assigned to a campus or a military base, and that's all you've got to do. And the higher you go up the organizational chart, the lower down you're really going. We just turn the chart upside down. And it takes greater renunciation. However, in our work, a navigator is a disciple maker, and if he's not working at disciple making, he's not a navigator, even if he's the president. Now, I can't spend 5 nights a week and part of the weekend on campus, but I can spend a little time doing it, just as a Christian, not as a navigator, necessarily, just because I'm a Christian. Well, now, when we come to the matter of an organization, getting things done with and through others, this leads to management. I didn't look up the reference. It says, where is that? Where no oxen are, the crib is clean, but much increases by the strength of the ox. Where is that in Proverbs? Come on, I got two assistants here. Neither one of you guys know that one. Let's see. What are we good for here? Where no oxen are, the crib is clean. But I should have taken time to look it up. Boy, I have a trouble keeping these Proverbs verses, the references straight, don't you? But nevertheless, you know the idea. If you don't have an ox, you don't have a barn to keep clean. You don't have an ox to take care of. But if you want to produce more crops, and so an ox can plow more ground than you can by hand, so you can produce more, but you have an added responsibility, haven't you? The ox. Now, maybe people in our organization would object to being compared to oxen. But you can do a certain amount of things yourself. You can write all your own letters, type your own things, do this, do that. But there comes a place where you may need someone to help you do your letters. But once you do that, you started an organization. And when you have an organization, then you have moved into an administrative responsibility. This is ministry we've talked about.
Proverbs 14:4.
Thank you. Proverbs 14:4. So you get more people responsible to you and with you in a team. So the question comes now, how are you going to organize this? So we turn to administry. We talked about ministry. Here's administry. Or management. I won't take time to try to, that means management, clarify some of these terms because they get used in different ways, but that's not the important thing tonight anyway. But now we turn to an illustration in Acts 6. We see what they did about an administrative problem. And we're well aware of this, of course, but I think we should review it. What was the problem? Acts 6. Widows were neglected. An administrative problem. So there was some complaint about it. What was the solution? Okay. It was to choose 7 men. And what did they say they were going to do? They're going to give themselves continually to what? Prayer and the ministry of the word. This meant a little challenge to me this summer as I thought about it. They just didn't give themselves to the study of the word, though that's necessary.
but to the ministry of the word. In other words, you've got to get out where the people are. That's the challenge to me.
So here was their priorities then. They were going to give themselves to prayer and to the ministry of the word, and they're going to delegate to certain kinds of qualified men the job of the ad ministry. Now let's turn back to Exodus chapter 18. Exodus chapter 18. Beginning with verse 19. And you recall what this is about, don't you? Jethro's advice to Moses. And do any of you have a Scofield Bible? Well, it just shows that the notes are not inspired. Because the note says that this is worldly wisdom. Well, I disagree. Because we have a perfect pattern of Acts 6 back in Exodus 18. When Jethro watched Moses all day long, and what was his problem? Too much work, too many problems, too much judging of people to do. So he said, "Listen now to my voice, and I will give you counsel, and God be with you. You shall represent the people before God and bring their cases to God." Now what is that?
That's prayer.
Secondly, "And you shall teach them the statutes and the decisions, and make them know the way in which they must walk and what they must do." To me, that sounds remarkably parallel to the ministry of the word. You should teach them. Thirdly, "Moreover, choose able men from all the people, such as fear God, men who are trustworthy and who hate a bribe, and place such men over the people as rulers of thousands, hundreds, fifties, tens, and so on, and let them judge." Choose your men. You're to choose them, place them, and let them judge. Now I wonder if that isn't a pretty basic priority list for us in the ministry. First, prayer. Second, the ministry of the word. Thirdly, men. How shall I organize my work? Put in my schedule, first of all, times for prayer. Secondly, for the study and the ministry of the word. And thirdly, for people. Now, there's a little parallel here, and I just put it up here. It's about the same thing I have over there. On the priorities, I guess. At least the typing, I think I went backwards. So this one here, yeah, there we are. Prayer. Represent before God, bring the cases to God. Exodus 18. Acts 6, we will give ourselves continually prayer. Exodus 18, teach them, make them know certain things. Acts 6, ministry of the word. Exodus 18, choose, place, let them. Acts 6, pick out a point to this duty. All right, let's see where we are at this point. Oh, yeah. We're at the seventh inning stretch. Let's stand up and stretch a bit, shall we? Well, let's leave it on. We'll I'll put this on there.
Now, I have my general philosophy or theology, from the Lordship of Christ and the authority of the Bible and all that goes into this, and we won't take time for philosophy of life, society, of work, and all this, and why meeting spiritual needs of legitimate work, and so on. We have our general aim, which is to win the lost, build the saved, train leadership, establish a church. Now I have people willing to help me. At the time I've got to turn around and help them. Now I come to below the line, I'm ready to manage. And the Sandy principles of management, which I've stolen and plagiarized from others and simplified for myself, are simply the alliteration of the word pole, P-O-L-E. Whatever else you do, if you're going to manage anything, whether it's a household, or a Friday night young people's social, or a church, or General Motors, or Jeannie Sandy's pom-pom group, the principles are the same. You got to plan, organize, lead, and evaluate. And that's about as simple as it can come, but I think it's basic. Now let me explain a little bit more what I mean by that. Pick up everything and get it backwards. Is that in focus? There, that's better. At least without my glasses, it's better. And there goes my secrets, too. Okay, planning. When have you planned? You have planned when there exists a clear statement of objectives and a workable program for their accomplishment. That's when you have planned. You have planned when there exists a clear statement of objectives and a workable program for their accomplishment. And the key word, as underlined in red there, is plan. Now, pardon me, objectives. Objectives. We'll talk about that just for a minute.
Thank you. Jethro said to Moses that you should teach these people what they must do. What are we out to accomplish? We need measurable, attainable, pass-onable objectives. Now, you might not like this, and I wouldn't blame you, because it probably took me 2 or 3 years to resolve some personal hang-ups, theological problems that I had with setting measurable, attainable objectives. Can you set measurable objectives in a spiritual ministry? And all I have to say is that you'll have to decide for yourself whether or not you think you can. But I will show you what we have done in the Navigators.
Simply by way of illustration. Here are our objectives for the Navigators from January 1, 70 through August 31 of 72. And these objectives are in the light of our 10-year objectives we have set for the 70. I didn't think you would get interested in getting to those. But this gives an idea of our corporate ministry objectives to be accomplished by August 31, 1972. The first was to produce 69 new area representatives to make our total of 74. We gave a lot of thought and prayer to this, and God seemed to bless us in the last 5 or 6 years with a 15% per year increase in our representatives. And the representative is the key to the Navigator staff. We have about 400 and some full-time, but we have about 140 representatives of that 400. So we set a goal of 69 new area representatives. That's 15% per year, and that includes a few for drop-off. So we set 69. then produced 1,980 new disciple makers at an annual ratio of 5 disciple makers to each representative. And this was one way that we may find a better one, to try to evaluate how we're doing in our ministry. I said it's one thing to have people in 24 countries, it's another thing to have a ministry. It's one thing to spend $3 or $4 million of the Lord's money, and I think we have some responsibility to see what we're getting for that. Now, if someone can come up with a better way, we are wide open to it. But this is one way that we've come up with, and that is that we ought to at least do this. Secondly, to produce 4,750 new disciples. That's an annual ratio of 12 to each rep. And how we arrived at that, that's another question. To increase our gift income by 25% per year. If our representatives increase by 15% per year, our gift income has to increase to 25% per year, because of inflation, one thing, the increase in size of families for another, before you've ever started the ministry. To establish England, Holland, Malaysia, Singapore, and Canada sending countries, in other words, specific, to send out 29 new missionaries and to open new works in Spain, France, Finland, Iran, Uganda, and Formosa. Now that's what I mean, at least for us, by specific ministry objectives. Now those are the objectives. The program for their accomplishment, of course, being worked out by the divisional directors and their people.
It might be well if I stopped right there. No, I tell you, I'll go on ahead there. Really, this is all quite simple. Your objectives,
hope, plan. You have planned when there exists a statement, a clear statement of objectives, and a workable program for their accomplishment. And I think that if you don't have a plan you can put on paper, you don't have a plan. That's my own opinion. Also, you find that the person with the plan leads the meeting regardless of who the chairman is. Isn't that true? That's why it seems to me that in leadership, you ought to go to a meeting with a plan all thought out in your own mind. And this is what takes the $9. You go into the meeting, but you don't tell them what your plan is. And you intend to come out of there with a better plan than you went in with. In other words, your objectives have to be set in participation with the people that are going to help carry them out, right? That's team leadership. I didn't. These are not my objectives. These are objectives I showed you that the navigators agreed on together we were going to shoot for. But man, I couldn't. I mean, how am I going to accomplish that by myself? Man, if I don't have a navigator, who have I got to be president of? I'm the most helpless guy in the navigators, really. I can't do a thing without asking somebody. It suddenly struck me that there was a time when I could do things. Now I can't go anywhere, but I got a divisional director to check with. The information, I got to ask somebody. Not only that, I used to think that, well, if I get in the saddle someday and Doss Trotman is gone and I can call the strokes, well, that'll be a great day. And I found out, of course, I had more bosses than I ever had in my life, just like you do. Except you've got about 20 times more than I do. Everybody's your boss. P-O-L-E, organizing. What's involved in organizing? You have organized when each one knows to whom, for whom, and for what each person on the team is responsible. That's all there's to it. When that's the case, you're organized. It's just that simple. And you might have the best organizational plan in the world, but if the members on the team don't know what they're supposed to do, you're not organized. You may have a terrible organizational structure, but if everybody knows what they're supposed to do, you are organized and you'll get things done. Whereas you won't if they don't know what they're doing. It's that simple, isn't it? That's when you're organized.
Now, my wife is a great organizer. And you know the simplest organization is a do list. That's all.
I learned from my wife that. She has a girl or two that help her on a couple of days a week. And this morning, as I walked out, I saw the little do list. There it was. Or Saturday comes, Jean. Vacuum upstairs. Up. Main bath. Straighten your bedroom. Judy. So on. And during the time when I told you that I had the household for those 4 months, well, I do that too, except I added Dad. And usually my list exceeded theirs. See, at that time I think we had 3 girls home. Yeah, Cheryl. I'm sure you've done this. It really takes the fuss out of the Saturday jobs. With one caution. Don't add anything new to the list. Be sure you thought of it ahead of time. Don't they get tired of that? I know my son, you say, I don't mind the list. But it does bother me when you keep adding to the list when I've got those things done. But that's organized. What's your job? Dad, wash cars, or get Dick Fisher to do it, and so on. But that's, you're organized when each person in the team knows what they're supposed to do. It's that simple. That's not a big problem. Now, it is true that in a little bigger organization, you have to choose people. And you choose them, of course, according to their gifts. That's where gifts come in. Then you have to place them. That's to delegate. And then you let them. And boy, there's a big one. One day, years ago, when the trains were still worth riding, came home from California, and I was sitting up in the dome car thinking about the people who really influenced my life. There was my dad, my first grade teacher, a coach in high school, the manager of Western Union for whom I worked, and Doss Trotman, who had adopted me as sort of his spiritual son. And you know, something dawned on me, that there was one thing that characterized all 5 of them that was just incalculable in its benefits to me, and that was this, that whether they actually did or not, they all gave me the impression that they trusted me. I know more than one occasion I could have gotten in trouble when I was away, and the very fact that I knew that my dad trusted me kept me out of it. Now, people have an immense need to be trusted. Doss Trotman said the greatest test of faith is not to trust God for food and for clothing, but to trust God for people. To let them. Let them judge. That's a whole topic in itself, isn't it? Okay, that's organizing. P-O-L-E. Not very complicated. Leading. Now, after giving quite a bit of thought to this, I have come to the conclusion that the key word in leading is decision-making, decisions. Now, when you're planning and organizing, you are making decisions too. But you are leading when the decisions you have made are being made. No, that's a mistake. When the decisions you ought to make are being made. When they should be made, and are being carried out. That the decisions you ought to make are being made when they ought to be made, and are being carried out. Now, there are certain things that we ought to decide if we're responsible for a work, and there are other things that other people ought to decide. And one of the kinds of decisions that a leader in any work needs to make are those that have to do with the future. And if we are dilatory in making those decisions, we hold up the whole process of things. Now, in our work, we ask someone to go to Japan as a navigator representative. And they're going to move their family over there and all that's involved in that. And a missionary is an expensive item, among other things. And they're going to take 3 years to learn a language. We better be sure that our plans are made far enough down the road to warrant the expenditure of that much of a segment of their lives. Well, what are your plans for Japan? Oh, I don't know. We're just sending a bunch of people over there.
Boy, that's totally unfair. And I try to keep in my mind about the kids, for instance, the wives. So we've got to be thinking out ahead.
No, of course, I realize that there are other things involved. You've got to decide these things. You've got to communicate them. And you have to motivate. That's all part of leadership, too. And coordinate to make sure that the orchestra plays off the same page.
But the key thing, I think, is decisions. And Jethro said to Moses, make them know the decisions. Where are we going? What are we going to do? How are we going to do it? Where are we going? Who's going to drive? What highway are we going to take? And then the fourth is simply to evaluate. Now, some management books call this control. But that doesn't work in our kind of a word. The word control. So I use the word evaluate. Evaluate. And here's this little statement. You have evaluated when you have compared where you are with where you should be and have analyzed the variables. And the key word is compare. You have a weekend conference, you're not finished until somebody has evaluated it. Where are you at the end of it? Where should you be? What's the cause for the variance? And then to put that information in the hands of somebody who can benefit from it for the next weekend conference. Now, the evaluation then leads to more planning, doesn't it? And you go through the cycle again and again and again. Now that's all there's to, as I see it. Planning, organizing, leading, and evaluating. Simple, isn't it? Now in evaluating, a little gimmick that's helped is, as I've indicated there, where are we? Where are we? Let's take we're trying to evaluate the young people's group or a specific Sunday school class. Where are we? Where should we be? Why the difference? The only shorthand I know is this little deal right there. Why the difference? What are we going to do about it? Okay, how are we in evangelism? Where are we in our church? Do we have any new Christians around today? Few. Where should we be? With a church like ours and an opportunity like ours. What would be a realistic determination of where we ought to be right now? Why the difference between those two? What's the cause? Where's our weakness? Where's our breakdown? We analyze that. We evaluate it. Then what are we going to do about it? And that goes around to planning, new objectives, program, then organizing so people know what they're to do, then leading out, evaluating, and so on. Now as an illustration, I'll expose the navigators to you a little bit more. I hope this doesn't sound too complicated. It's a little simpler when you've worked with it for a little bit. And now we made an evaluation of where the navigators are. So are those 3-year objectives I talked about? Okay. As of May 1971, here's where we are. The goal, to produce 69 new area reps. Representatives, that is, we expect to have 52 by December 31st. We need 17 more than 72, but we have 43 possibilities. So we may exceed that goal by 26. So, you know what I expect to do in the next 3-year set of goals? To up the goal to 25% per year. I think there's a good possibility that we could healthily double our staff in the next
see me appear.
Well, we should have 1,980 new disciple makers. By as of May 71, we should have had 790 towards that goal. We actually had 711, which puts us behind. And we analyzed the problem. The new disciple, we should have had 1,892. We had 2,400, so we're ahead there. The gift income should be 25% per year. 70 over 69 was 44% increase. And the first quarter of 71 showed a 26.2% increase. Then we had a note to ourselves. We approved a budget increase of 30% for 71. So keep an eye on it. Then we just went ahead and evaluated where on the other goals. They established England, Malaysia, Singapore, and Canada as sending countries. England, 72. Well, we made it this year. Malaysia, Singapore, we made it this year. Holland and Canada had to be recycled. We couldn't make those goals. And then we made adjustments accordingly, figured out why, and went to work on it.
Now, I know one thing about all this. There is no doubt in the minds of navigator staff around the world what it is we're after. Some I get little remarks back about the numbers game. And I don't blame them. I don't like all reports and all that stuff either. But I do know this. They know where we're going. And I don't find anybody coming up to any of our leaders and saying, tell me what, once more, what is that that we're supposed to be doing? It's all very clear. Some don't like it. Some think there's too much emphasis here, not enough there. But they know where we're headed. And another thing about it, if we don't like it, we can change it. But if you don't have anything there, what have you got to change? You can't put your finger on it. It's always slipping away from you. It's like a peeled grape. You can't get it. See, and year after year, we think, man, we'd be the nicest people that ever went out of business. You know, we just all love one another. We're just great gang and all. We love the fellowship. But where's the results? Why are we in business? Where are those converts? Where are those disciples, those disciple makers? Where is that leadership coming along? Those are hard questions. I remember we had one fellow left our staff over this some years ago. He said, Doss Trotman came to him and said, now where are your men? He said, Doss, you have no right to ask me where are our men. That's just something you can't come along and ask. That's the fruit of the Spirit. It wasn't until years later that I happened to come across the answer to that. Faith is also the fruit of the Spirit. And Jesus said, where is your faith? Now, what it means is, it gives you a basis on which to ask some questions. When you evaluate, where are we? Where should we be right now? Why the variances? What can we do about them? Man, you know I feel a sermon coming on. I'll just give you the heart of it. 1 Corinthians 9. Wow, there's a great one. 9:24 to 27 on how a small group can make a big impact. But just one part. He says, well, I do not run aimlessly. I know where I'm going. And I do not box as one beating the air. I just don't swing and miss. I connect. It isn't how often you swing the axe, it's how often you make a good blow on that tree that cuts it down.